It's hard to believe, but it's been almost exactly 1 year since we had a lesson on the church at Ephesus. Back March 1st of last year, right before the situation with COVID and everything hit, we had a lesson on the church at Ephesus. And the church at Ephesus, as we noted regarding the example that we have given to us by what Jesus writes to that church, he describes this congregation in those first couple of verses of Revelation chapter 2 in a way that would leave you with the impression that, man, this was as close to a perfect church as you could think of. If we notice what it is that Jesus says to the angel of the church at Ephesus, write, as he says in verse 1, "These things says he who holds the seven stars." And he goes on to describe their faithfulness. He says in verse 2 that you cannot bear those who are evil. As he says, you have tested those who say they are apostles and are not, and have found them liars. Goes on to say, you've persevered, verse 3, and have patience and have labored for my name's sake and have not become weary. When you consider the example of what Jesus writes to this church, it gives the impression of a church that is doing everything that they should be doing. And in fact, there are quite a number of good things that Jesus says about this congregation. Things that they should continue to do. However, as we continue and we see what Jesus says in verse 4, "Nevertheless, I have this against you." And we find that Jesus condemns them for having left their first love. And what was intended to have been a series of lessons starting back March 1st on the churches of Asia, we're going to try and pick up every now and then on a different church of Asia going forward. We have the example of the church at Ephesus, and next we're going to study the church at Smyrna. Now, I want you to imagine with me an individual who is writing to others, and maybe they're going through and talking about the pros and cons, perhaps, of just as scouts do for pro athletes. This athlete is really good at these things, but he needs to work on these things. These are the areas in which this athlete is lacking. Well, imagine there was someone who was writing about you or me. We can individually, as Joe mentioned in his prayer, consider the areas perhaps that we are doing well in, that we can always certainly do better. And perhaps we can also understand the areas of our lives that we need to improve. And if someone were to write down Jesus, perhaps, were to write a letter or write a pro and con list, here's what this individual does well, here's the areas that this person lacks, it's important for us to be able to sit down and say, okay, here's my strengths, here's my weaknesses, here's the areas I need to improve. But what about as a congregation? And this is certainly one of the examples that we have from the church at Ephesus with regard to the fact that as good as a church may look outwardly, there may always be a situation involving motivation. There may be a problem involving their, what Jesus describes as, their first love. And that was a problem for the church in Ephesus. So as we begin here in Revelation chapter 2, starting in verse 8, we're going to look at this church in Smyrna, and we're going to consider what Jesus' words are. Because imagine, if you will, a pro scout writing to a ball club and saying, "This athlete has no weaknesses. This athlete is perfect. There is nothing bad. All they have is good." Because that's what we find, at least in terms of what Jesus writes regarding the church at Smyrna. Starting in Revelation chapter 2 and in verse, let's start in verse 8. Jesus says, "Unto the angel of the church in Smyrna write, these things says the first and the last, he which was alive," or "which was dead and is alive. verse 9, I know your works. This is the map that we looked at before of the different churches of Asia and the seven churches of in the region of Asia Minor here. And this is Ephesus, and now we've moved on to Smyrna. So as Jesus begins this introduction, remember how Jesus, he always introduces himself in such a way that kind of harkens back to chapter 1. And the way in which John saw Jesus in the Spirit in Revelation 1, the ways in which Jesus introduces himself to these seven churches in these letters, it emphasizes Jesus' authority. And the fact that Jesus, being the Son of God, is the highest authority for the church. And when Jesus says these things, says the first and the last. Moving on to Revelation 20:21, we're going to see the concept of how that Jesus refers to himself as the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. And when it comes to the authority that the Father had granted him, he is the first and last authority for the church. Not only that, but being the Son of God, being the one, the only true Son of God, the Messiah, and there are many ways in which the fact that he is the first and the last applies in the Alpha and the Omega. He which was dead and is alive. Obviously, the reference to the resurrection of the dead, Jesus being raised never to die again, but it also emphasizes or reemphasizes what we're told in Romans chapter 1 and in verse 4, how that Jesus was declared to be the Son of God with power through the resurrection of the dead. God proved it. And of course, you can link in there Acts chapter 17 as well, verse 31, where Paul references the fact that there is going to be a day of judgment, and God has guaranteed this by raising Jesus from the dead. And then he says in verse 9, I know your works. To every one of the churches, he says, I know your works. Whether they're bad works, good works, or non-existent works, Jesus knows. He is aware of everything that the church in Ephesus is doing, everything that the church in Smyrna is doing. And so notice the good things that Jesus says starting in verse 9. He says, I know your works and tribulation and poverty, but thou art rich. And I know the blasphemy of those who say they are Jews but are not, and are of the synagogue of Satan. Verse 10, fear none of those things which you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil shall cast some of you into prison that you may be tried, and you shall have tribulation 10 days. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you a crown of life. Notice what Jesus says regarding their perseverance. He says, I know your tribulation, I know your poverty, and I know the blasphemy of those who are persecuting you. These are three main aspects that Jesus brings out regarding what he knows is taking place in Smyrna, and how that these brethren in Smyrna are enduring. They are persevering despite, first of all, the tribulation that they're facing. The term tribulation, it means grievous trouble, severe trial or suffering. It's a very broad term. Certainly, one could include poverty and persecution under the concept of tribulation. But Jesus mentions, he says, you have endured poverty. And of course, Jesus says, but thou art rich. And of course, the reference here being they're rich in faith. They're rich in serving God, even though physically they may be poor. And then he says, I know the blasphemy of those who say they are Jews, verse 9, but are not, and are of the synagogue of Satan. I don't think it's that they're lying. I think they profess themselves to be Jews. What Jesus is describing is similar to what Paul referenced regarding a Jew indeed. One who is truly circumcised not only of the flesh, but also of the heart. One who obeys the law, or obeyed the law of Moses by faith, not accounting their obedience to the law as righteousness for themselves. What Jesus is describing, they claim to be Jews, but they're not true Jews. Because true Jews obey in faith, the just shall live by faith. True Jews understand what the truth of God's word says, and they abide by it. However, these Jews, as Jesus says, are of the synagogue of Satan, which suggests specifically that the synagogue in Smyrna of the Jews there is one that was not serving God the way that they were supposed to. And obviously, certainly, they were still serving the old law, which had been done away with. And then as he goes on to say in verse 10, notice how Jesus specifically refers to a trial which is to come. It's not enough that they have been facing trial already, but notice Jesus says, fear none of those things which you are about to suffer. Well, they've already suffered. Jesus says, you're going to suffer a little bit more. He says, behold, the devil shall cast some of you into prison. Whether or not this is a connection back to the quote synagogue of Satan, that the source of this problem is going to be from the Jews themselves. There are some who make that connection between the devil and Satan there in verse 9 and 10. Or for whatever reason, the fact that their faith ultimately is the reason that they're going to be cast into prison. That you may be tried, he says in verse 10, and you shall have tribulation 10 days. Now whether Jesus means a literal 10 days or a figurative 10 days, obviously, there are several occasions throughout the Old and New Testaments where the number 10 seems to reference a term of completion. And there are times where 10 is used both literally and figuratively. And at times figuratively to represent the idea of a complete term or a complete time. Whether Jesus is being literal here regarding being in prison for 10 days, or he's being figurative in the sense that there's going to be a time that you're going to be cast into prison, and this will take place in the fullness of the time that you're going to be in prison. He says, be faithful unto death, and I will give you a crown of life. He's encouraging them. With Ephesus, he says, I know your works. You're doing all the right things. But then in verse 5, he says you're doing them for the wrong reason. Or at least in some form or fashion, their heart was not, or their motivation was not right. They had left their first love. With Smyrna, he says, I know your works. You are persevering. You're enduring great hardship, great trial. And there's more coming. Now, Jesus isn't saying this to kind of heap on to someone and to these brethren who are already dealing with a load. He's warning them and encouraging them. He says there's going to be a little bit more. And it would seem to be that this is going to be a peaking of this trial and tribulation. That what they're about to face is going to be worse than what they've faced before. But then when he goes on to say in verse 10, here's the motivation. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you a crown of life. The same type of crown that Paul refers to in 2 Timothy chapter 4, the crown of righteousness. Several occasions, the idea of this crown that awaits those who are faithful. But notice Jesus says, be faithful unto death. Jesus doesn't say that you will be thrown in prison, but you'll all be fine. He doesn't say that you'll be thrown in prison and everybody will survive. You may have to suffer a couple of beatings, but you'll be okay. Jesus says, be faithful unto death. Which suggests, perhaps, that there were some brethren who were going to be killed because of their faith. They had already faced tribulation and poverty and hostility from others. Now they may in fact face being killed for their faith. But Jesus is encouraging these brethren that in the end, this is why you've suffered already. I mean, the whole reason they've been willing to suffer tribulation and poverty and hostility from these Jews in Smyrna is because of their faith for a reward one day. And Jesus emphasizes that reward That the same motivation that led you to endure and persevere through these other trials is the same motivation that will help you persevere through this. Verse 11, he that has an ear to hear, let him hear what the Spirit says unto the churches. He that overcomes shall not be hurt by the second death. And of course, Revelation chapter 20, we know the second death is being cast in the lake of fire. A lake that burns continually, where the torment of Satan and his angels and all those who are wicked continues forever. Ultimately, Jesus provides two motivations. One is encouragement to reach forward to the prize, a crown of life, this home in heaven, this the very thing that John's going to describe later in Revelation. The overcoming of God's people over the trials of this world, and ultimately reaching that home in heaven. But on the flip side, what's another motivation? Not only do I want that crown of life, but I don't want to face that second death. I don't want to be cast into that lake of fire. When we talk about fear, fear is a very good motivator. And it's not that fear, sometimes people link the concept of fear to some kind of a negative connotation. But we've mentioned this before. When you think about a race car driver, they're driving for that cup or that prize, whatever it is at the end of that finish line. But those walls on either side of them, they know if they stray to the right or too far to the left, they're going to hit those walls, they're going to spin out, and they're not going to make it to the finish line. So those walls keep them focused on the prize. Well, in many ways, this is what Jesus is doing for these brethren in Smyrna. He's focusing them. Here's your reward. Here's what you're going after. Stay focused on that prize. Do not stray to the right or to the left. Don't let your faith waver, because you don't want to take part in that second death. You want the crown of life. So, what does Jesus say bad about the church in Smyrna? With Ephesus, you have left your first love. In fact, Jesus even called for the church at Ephesus to repent. And if they didn't, he would remove their candlestick from his presence. Meaning he would no longer recognize the church of Ephesus as a church of his people. What does Jesus say bad about Smyrna? One of the shortest of the letters to the churches. Just verses 8 through 11, and that's it. There is nothing bad said about Smyrna. This can only be said of a few of these churches in Asia who needed to be encouraged, who needed to be reminded, and in many cases, who needed to be corrected. The church in Smyrna, they were doing what they were supposed to do to serve God. What does it say about the church in Smyrna? They were focused on obeying him and standing for the truth. And the question for us is, could this be said of us as well? Could it be said of the Wichita Falls congregation that they have great perseverance? That they endure tribulation, verse 9. That they are willing to endure hostility and poverty and whatever trials they may face. That they stay focused, and even in the face of what might be coming in the case of Smyrna, I have every reason to think that the brethren in Smyrna remained faithful. And not in a little part because of Jesus' encouragement here in Revelation chapter 2. To have a letter written directly to them, encouraging them that it's going to get worse. And the implication is some of you may die. And that's okay. Would we be willing to go that far for our faith. Be willing to stand in the face of persecution and die faithfully, looking forward to a crown of life. If Jesus were to write a letter to the church at Wichita Falls, if he were to write a list of things you do well, and then he were to start a list of things that you need to correct, would he have anything to put in that list? For Smyrna, at least for what we have here, there was nothing on that con list or that correction list. Could the same be said of us? This is why it's important for us to examine ourselves, as Joe mentioned in his prayer, both individually and as a congregation. A congregation is only as strong as its members are. And not just its strongest members, but all of its members. It's important that all of us be focused not only on serving God individually, but also helping this congregation to grow in faith and in willingness to stand for the truth. The lesson is yours this morning. Hope that's something for us to think about, to focus our minds and our hearts on serving God, and to remind ourselves that brethren throughout the last 2,000 years, and ultimately really throughout time, all faithful people of God have had to face trial. But all faithful people of God, Hebrews 11, have been willing to back up their faith with obedience, no matter what the cost was. Let's make sure that we're willing to do the same. No matter how bad our society may get in its how it views people who are religious or spiritual, how it views quote-unquote Christianity, let's make sure we're willing to stand for the truth no matter what. We offer an invitation to those who are not Christians to be baptized this morning. Be added to the body of Christ. Be added to one of the churches, one of the candlesticks in the presence of the Lord. And then from that point on, serving faithfully. Those of us who are Christians, let's make sure we're examining ourselves. This is part of the reason why when we take the Lord's Supper, Paul encourages us in 1 Corinthians 11, as he encouraged the Corinthians, to examine yourself. Let a man examine himself and then partake of the bread and the fruit of the vine. Make sure our motivation is right. Make sure our heart is right. Our mind is right. Not only in partaking of the bread and the fruit of the vine, but in making sure that we're serving God appropriately. One way to blaspheme the Lord's Supper is to take the Lord's Supper, knowing full well that I'm not living a life that's right before God. We offer an invitation. If you need help in any way this morning, come forward as we stand and sing.